This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the results, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
When I go home late at night, this is a song that I really like to sing right now, so I'll play it for you. It's called My Old Man.
Rodriguez. Gonna have a go in off the post. Two goals in 4 minutes for West Bromwich Albion, and they're 2-0 up against their rivals. Jay Rodriguez doubles the advantage right before the break.
Welcome to the My Old Man Said podcast. I'm David Michael, the editor of myoldmansaid.com. And joining me on another fantastic show, Dan Rogers of the villaunderground.com. And Chris Burke.
Welcome Chris. To the end of season party.
The end of the world and the beginning of the park.
Oh, I want to be part of the park.
You're on the beach, my lord.
This is John Terry's business plan. He thought, right, I'm starting a swimwear company. I'm going to start a swimwear company. How can I get more money out of this? How can I maximise my profits? I know. I will become a coach of a football club, probably that Aston Villa one, because I've already got links there, so I should be a shoo-in. Ruin their season early. All the players will be on the beach. I'll be able to sell them swimming trunks and bikinis in February ahead of schedule. Master business plan by John Terry. Master business plan. What did Bruce say about the season only really begins when the daffodils start to arrive?
I'm sure it was when you could smell the hot dogs. It was always when you could smell the hot dogs from Bruce. When the hot dogs are pushing out of the ground.
Followed by the daffodils. But I don't think there's going to be any daffodils this year, unfortunately.
Just
they've
lilies.
All been killed by Dean Smith's toxic
poison. This is going to be some comeback, though, isn't it? I mean... You didn't expect Neil Taylor to fire us to promotion, but when it happens, my God, it's going to be some party.
Well, all these people who are trying to summarise why it's all gone wrong, and they're all saying Grealish is out. If Grealish comes back in this next week or two and fires us to 10 consecutive wins, then I will believe their synopsis of why we have failed this season. But until then
you can just lie awake at night dreaming to be someone like Bristol City.
So anyway, coming up in the show, we will end the show with a big debate on Dean Smith.
Ooh.
We will try to make sense of some of the conspiracy theories, the lame comparisons that people are telling themselves just so they can sleep at night regarding Dean Smith's managerial career so far and the next season. The rational way of looking at Dean Smith so far and what we should be expecting, what we can expect. We'll also have the normal 3 points to kick off the show, where we go to crazy Italian games, an interesting Welsh stroke French situation, and also the result of Spygate as well. And along the way, We will discuss the Beggies game. We'll probably sniff at the Brentford game a little. We'll talk about toxicness at Villa Park. We'll talk about being part of the park. And back by popular demand, the Scott Hogan touch count meter will reappear. For he has graced a football pitch once again.
And he has feet, confirmed.
Right, at the top of the show, you heard, I think I mentioned this on Twitter. I was watching the Baggies game and there was a couple of seats away behind me. There was, she must have been about four years old, this girl, very sweet girl, who was, and that footage actually came, it was probably around the 90th minute. She threw out the whole game, and that footage was basically, all you can hear is the Baggies away fans versus this 1 4-year-old Villa supporting girl. She took them on her own.
The Villa youth.
Where the rest of you were, I have no idea. But an outstanding effort. And that was probably the only ray of light I've got from Villa in the last few weeks. I just thought, the youth bring us hope.
It was a bad 7 days.
Should have been 9 points, shouldn't it? It was a 9-point week. And
apparently,
we ended up with one. And that was basically Villa's playoff hopes being kneecapped within the space of a week. Right, before we get into the 3 points, I just want to give a quick shout out. I haven't done any patron shout outs for the last week or so. So, thank you very much, Mr. Leighton Nunn, Mark Parry as well, Tom Clark, Paul McAllister, Rob Hayes, Kevo Sullivan. Also, thanks very much to Gary Hogan, Patrick Singleton, and Anders Vilken for, and I'm guessing at that pronunciation, for upping their pledges as well. And please do help the show. We're looking to get some mics in, so any help will help us improve the quality of the show, because we're still trying to battle how we record it. And if we can improve the quality of the initial recording, then that makes editing quicker, and we can easily do 2 shows instead of 1 a week. So please become a patron. Go to myoldmansaid.com and check out the patron option on the menu bar. Also, if you're listening on iTunes and Spotify, please follow and subscribe as well. And if you want to get closer to us and communicate more with us, join the Mad Few Facebook group as well. The link is in the program notes, and I'll also put it up again on Twitter, etc.
Trips to the park included.
Actually, I had a good weekend. Actually, the only thing that ruined it was West Brom.
As always,
I was out to about 6 a.m. entertaining Norwegian villains
with a great, we've got a great flag.
Fight like lions, drink like Vikings.
Love it.
And I took him to the Digbeth Diner, which was very good as always.
Then solid we choice.
Picked up some new friends and ended up at the Old Crown before I coerced people to the Night Owl. And from the Night Owl, we ended up at some gay club and we converted the Norwegian villain. No, actually, I got propositioned.
And then Dave tried to ride a bike home. Drunk.
At 6 a.m. And I didn't achieve one straight line. But the hardest part was getting up in the morning to go to Villa Park. And the only way I managed that was, in the end, was just to call a Uber and just kind of roll into it and get him to drop me off at the doorstep.
In the centre circle.
Yeah. Chris, the Norwegian, our Viking friend, told me at Brentford behind the goal, he was talking to some Villa fan. And he said, oh, that David Michael, he's a wanker. He doesn't even live in Birmingham. Sorry to disappoint you. And disappoint myself, I do live in Birmingham.
Such civic pride.
Let's get on to
Talk
these
about
3 points.
Shitting on your doorstep.
Oh, no, dear. Digbeth Diner stands proud. It's one of the finest establishments. It stands up against anything in the whole world. So that's where I plant my flag for Birmingham. Anyway, moving on to the 3 points. Chris Budd, kick us off.
Starting off this week with, you know, proof that there's always somebody who's worse off than you, even in the darkest days of Villa, with Italian team Pro Piacenza, who managed to field 7 players against Cineo, I think they're pronounced. It had 6 youth team players and a masseur, which is a very strong way to play a team. So they only managed 7 players because everybody else hasn't been paid. So everyone else refused to turn up.
Could have been us so easily, couldn't it? We'd have been
fielding. And they had an 18-year-old who was both the captain and the manager.
Who's that guy who's Jack Grealish's physio? Is it Ollie Stevenson? He could have been the captain and manager this season.
And wow. We'd probably still be challenging for the playoffs.
Yeah, probably.
A little controversial.
And you know, local media outlet Sport Piacenza were so appalled they decided to stop their live feed of the game after 3 minutes, which wasn't a bad idea because it ended up 20-0.
Oh.
16-0 at halftime, though, so a sterling second half performance.
And they did quite well second half.
Very good. Right, point number two, Dan Rogers.
I don't know why it is that running a website like I do, I get all the ones involving litigation. But this story, it is my specialist area. It's my niche.
Specialist,
it's your field of expertise.
And this is the, it's becoming slightly more unsavory, isn't it, now, with the Emiliano Sala saga, I suppose. And it's all coming down to money after the tragedy. And
it always
does. Well, it always does, and you know, it's a lot of money, circa £15 million or euros. I mean, there's not a lot between it these days. But it's the story is that Cardiff are looking to sue Nantes, and it has implications, I think, particularly for into the world of agents, because it's transpiring in leaked emails that the agent might have inflated the price on the suggestion there were other interested parties, when lo and behold, there were none. So that's interesting to think that.
Has Cardiff already paid?
No, they've not. They've been sitting on it, and I think they've probably been sitting on it for two reasons. Probably maybe out of respect, because I do believe his funeral was only a few days ago. And perhaps whilst they're considering their position, because there's some debate over whether he'd actually completed his signing, isn't there? Because his registration to the Premier League, I don't think, had gone through.
In other news, point number three, finally, the English Football League have announced, well, they've reached their conclusion, as their email said, that Leeds United did, in observing opponents' training sessions, is in breach of Regulation 3.4.
No, not 3.4.
Oh, yes, 3.4. 3.4 provides that in all matters and transactions relating to the league, each club shall behave towards each other club and the league in the utmost good faith. When have we ever behaved in the utmost good faith to any team?
You know, that's regulation 3.4. Villa concede 3.4 goals a game. That is the utmost good faith.
You do have a very valid point there. Right, if we're not giving away 3 points, we're giving away 3 goals at least.
Can you imagine what if someone spied on the Villa? Would they get fined for spying on the Villa?
They'd get laughed at.
Well, anyway, Leeds were fined 200,000, inclusive of a contribution to costs. And as we said when we mentioned this on the podcast a few episodes ago, we knew there would suddenly bring in some law, which they have done, which is basically saying clubs will be expressly prohibited from viewing the opposition training in the 72 hours immediately prior to the fixture, unless invited to do so.
we would invite people to prove we do actually practice. No, honestly, we do. We do practice corners, set pieces and attacking occasionally.
Yeah. Right, before we get on to Villa matters, although you could argue this is loosely linked to Aston Villa, big news, Scott Hogan has entered the field of play, and so we can click on the touch count meter. He managed actually 90 minutes, which is some kind of miracle when you look back at his
time. No injuries either.
No injuries. Bagged an assist. And
what is this sorcery?
24 touches, which probably the last two seasons in a Villa shirt combined probably got to about 22 touches. And that was in Sheffield United's 4-0 win over Reading. That's how you deal with Reading. Villa took 2 points off Reading. The Blades just blow them away 4-0. That's how you meant to deal with Reading.
Isn't it amazing how the 3-3 draw that we had was supposed to be our springboard for rejuvenating our season, yet it's been Sheffield United's ticket to remind themselves that actually they're quite a good team.
Yeah, because they also beat Middlesbrough in the next game after they did draw. And I noticed that Chris Wilder rotates his forwards. He played sharp against Middlesbrough, and then against Reading they rested their normal front two forwards and put Hogan in and I forgot who the other chap is. And they
Medine, isn't it? Is it Gary Medine?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And then they've got the lad from Ipswich as well, haven't they?
So there you've got a manager who seems to know exactly what he's doing to ensure at least a playoff anyway. I think they're still in with a good shout, I think, of bagging automatic. Mm. Leeds are lucky because they've got a couple of easy fixtures, but if they slip up there, then I think Sheffield United are still very much in the mix. I think the Baggies are as well. I think it's two from those four, realistically. Norwich.
I think, one of those four, I think, is going to be very unlucky that they don't go up, be it automatically in the playoffs, because those four teams are all pretty deserving of, you know, a shot.
Yeah, very quickly, I can't believe this is the best marketing tagline they could come up with for...
It is the worst marketing tagline they could possibly... save for having brought that girl back from the Middle East who was been with ISIS and parading her as a new player, this is the worst thing that they could possibly have done. Please continue, Mr.
I am part of the park. Dan, can you please regale what you read to me earlier on? I think it was a tweet that you noticed.
It's that bad. I was almost in disbelief. But there's a fantastic tweet from Ms. Gilbert 1805 on Twitter, which says, "Did anyone else notice the new season ticket posters saying part of the park, now instead of part of the pride? We're no longer prepared and no longer have pride. So what's left? Oh, the park. We still have the park. So let's use that. Oh, I can't wait to be part of the park." Said no one fucking ever. Jesus, it's so bad. And I invite people to go onto the club website, and they have also colluded to produce the worst set of graphics ever in graphic design to accompany them. It's dreadful.
Woeful.
People got paid good money to come up with this. In the marketing department. But, you know, why pay like 500-odd quid? I'm going to become part of the park by just going to Cannon Hill Park, I think. It's for free.
And it's fun and relaxing.
No, exactly.
It doesn't infuriate you week in, week out.
There's plenty of parks in Birmingham. It's one of the biggest green belt cities in this country. So if you want to be part of the park, choose your nearest park and just hang out there on a Saturday for free.
Part of the park. Oh,
I'm going to just start bringing your dog to Villa Park. That'll confuse them.
Yeah. Bring some bread for the ducks and away you go.
Just all go cruising in the park after dark.
Oh, Dan, that's Cannock Chase.
Oh, you know it's my neck of the woods. Look, litigation and Cannock Chase, they're my two niche areas.
We're not going to go into too much detail in the recent games.
Because they were shit.
Brentford, it would take us about 10 seconds to describe our possession in that game, because pretty much every time a ball... I think we strung two passes together. Every time a Brentford player put a misplaced pass in or Villa got a tackle in, suddenly the ball was straight back to him like it was a hot potato or something. And that was kind of embarrassing. I mean, the most you can say about Villa is I thought they were organised defensively better than they have been for a long time. Although Brentford were making a meal of possession.
The Brentford overplayed, didn't they? It staggered me that actually Villa probably had the two best chances of the game and wasted them.
Yeah, and that was also a problem before West Brom scored as well. We had a great Tammy Abraham chance.
My overriding thing from the Brentford game was Smith's post-match interview, where he said, you know, obviously their performance has been built over 3 years and we knew what was going to come our way. And you think, wow, that's kind of the crap that Bruce was coming out with for a while, in that, well, if you knew that what was coming your way and you've had weeks to prepare them, either A, what were you doing on the training field, or B, bloody hell, those players didn't, you know, put your plan into action very well.
It's taken 3 years to build a team that before that game kicked off were 18th in the Championship.
Yes, it was the first time I've heard an entire press conference from him, and
I thought, wow.
It was a bit of a let's big up the Brentford show as well. And
yeah, I think you could tell his pride was really hurt.
Well, I thought we were bang average, and we had two great chances and we should have took them, but we didn't. And the glaring thing for me, and it carried into the Albion game, is that what's our measure now for being a good team? Because we didn't, in neither game did we change it up or look at I think our formation was completely wrong in the Brentford game as well.
Well, when I see Villa fans on social media ejaculating over Brentford, it really is a cause for concern in terms of the levels dropping.
Yeah.
I mean, no disrespect to Brentford, you know, they punch above their weight, but there's so many deficiencies in that team. And if you look at and read articles by Brentford fans and Brentford websites, they spell out the deficiencies in their team over the last few years and how Smith hit a glass ceiling. And we'll talk about Dean Smith and Brentford in the second half of the show. But and I'll also mention this comparison. I mean, one of the things back in the day when Graham Turner took over Villa from Tony Barton was, he was from Shrewsbury. He was meant to be this hot new English manager. There's a few comparisons with Smith, which I'll mention later on. But when he started and his coaching staff started talking about this, what they used to do at Shrewsbury to the Villa players, the Villa players who had just a couple of seasons ago won the European Cup, season before had won the Super Cup, as good as any team in Europe. Suddenly you're being told, well, we do this at Shrewsbury. And players lose a lot of respect. And I don't know if there's a little bit of that of what's suddenly happened now, because it's night and day between the first half dozen games under Smith to what's been happening pretty much the whole of this year. West Brom, I thought, Darren Moore, as soon as he got that 1-2 sucker punch before half-time, just knew it was game, set and match. He set them up really deep. And they obviously knew that Villa were capable of fighting back in games and just thought, right, we'll tighten it up, tighten all the spaces, make sure they can't get any traction down the flanks, make sure there's no space inside, and we'll see this game out. And we didn't have an answer.
Unsurprisingly, Barry was the man of the match, he was the best player on the field by a mile.
Yeah.
And at what is he, 37, 38 now? Gave them everything that we've lacked in midfield for months. Controlled the game, was physical, dictated the tempo, just dominated, and very deservedly got a good standing ovation, actually, when he was subbed off.
Yeah, and when you think about it, it is perhaps his last ever game at Villa Park, and he played approaching 450 games for Villa in all competitions, and that's 2, 3, 4 times the amount of games that some Villa players played who are now called legends on social media, mentioning no names.
And he was consistent, like every week.
I remember him when he was making his first appearances in 98 under...
He's superb.
Gregory, sometimes he played left back, sometimes he played the left side of a three-man centre-back setup, and his control. I remember being quite low in the Trinity, close to his touchline on the left-hand side, and I was like, this guy's head and shoulders above these guys in terms of just natural skill and technique and control.
He just makes the game look easy, doesn't he? He's a very simple player. He's not complicated.
And that's what made me think about this eternal DM situation in terms of Villa, playing this Conor Hourihan quarterback, or do you have somebody who's allegedly a bit more effervescent like Bjarnason, or do you have Jedinak for the more aerial physical defence, or Whelan to keep it ticking by? There's nobody who's super composed like Barry is.
But Bambari does all of those things.
There's not, but I can never recall, if you were to plonk Barry into our team against the Albion, that he would suffer like any ball-playing player would, I think, in the Villa team does at the moment.
Yeah.
That we don't seem to have any out ball.
No, there's no option.
Abraham's very, very isolated. And it seems the last few games that we've made one of the most potent strikers in the division bafflingly isolated, really. But just going back to Barry, people have short memories, I think, that, you just mentioned he played 450 games. When Villa were at the top level, competing to be at the top table, to coin a phrase he used in a recent podcast. And he became a full England international, not because we didn't have good midfielders at the time. That was when England had very, very good central midfield options. So, it's a measure of how far we've drifted, really, that a player who comes with all that experience and all his age can come to Villa Park and impress as he did.
And some I saw some people on social media saying it's disgusting that we'd give a round of applause to to an opposition player. And that's when you just think, these are the types of idiots that don't really get football and the traditions of football. I remember Villa fans giving Steven Gerrard a round of applause when he was subbed off when we played them in a 1-1 draw, because he'd just bossed the whole game. He was head and shoulders above everybody, and it was football fans appreciating good players. And in this respect, as well as being the best man on the pitch in this particular game, obviously potentially his last game ever,
there's context, isn't it?
Played 12 years at the club. Who the hell plays that and consistently as good? We're not talking about
and was very seldom injured compared to the modern mob, wasn't it?
And if Martin O'Neill got his act together and got us into those Champions League places, he would have stayed at Villa. He only went on because he saw it was a dead end. And getting back to the twilight of his career, there was a potential chance, because he wanted to return to the area, that he would come back to Villa. But Villa got relegated, and so he had to go and end up at the Albion. By the way, I share the same barber as Gareth Barry. He's a mate of Gareth Barry's, so I know.
Oh, good.
Know a few things about Bazza. Not for this podcast. That will be for the X-rated podcast will be a patron-only show. Hopefully, patrons that won't grass us up to the authorities. I suppose when you're talking about the last week, Sheffield United still is there. But the last two games, and even Sheffield United, I suppose, Mings obviously looks really good. I mean, he's pretty much the only player that doesn't get catcalled with abuse at Villa Park nowadays. Courtney House, I thought, was improved vastly against the Albion. Elphick was all right and was unlucky when his header bounced off the bar. I think the turning point, and I don't think Villa did enough to get anything else from the game apart from being beaten, but if Abraham had scored that chance where he was clean through, and I've noticed this is not the first time where I think it was Green had the ball. Abraham's totally free. It's an obvious ball for Green to play. You know, he's there. Unless he's blind, he's going to play him in. And Abraham is pointing, is screaming, is waving his arms around. And when the ball that's coming anyway comes, he's so off balance because he's been waving his hands and pointing that his first touch completely lets him down. And that happened before. I think it was Bolasie. Yeah, Bolasie played him through. Yeah, I think against the Albion away. And he was like waving his arms, screaming at Bolasie. Bolasie slipped him through and he was off balance because he was flapping around so much. So if I was a coach at Villa, I would just, you know, give him a bit of video playback and say, look, we pay this guy on the wing to play this ball. If you're free, he's going to play it. So you don't need to like flap around.
It's his job.
Like a
it's
Muppet.
A sure thing, isn't it, really?
Well, is it with Green? That's the thing.
Well, let's not slag off Green just yet. Save that until next time.
Relegation.
But no, so there is that. But that's, I mean, that's part of the parcel of his enthusiasm. And you can't fault his effort and endeavour because he's running around like a madman. And if he was a bit more stationary, I think it would be even more apparent how isolated he is from the midfield. Conor Hourihan, he makes a pass. When he's in the opponent's half, he makes the pass. He play it out wide or he play it on the inside. And then he just stops. He should carry on running to, A, provide another option, and also, B, to link up with Abraham and get closer to him.
Do you, taking Hourihan because he's the whipping boy of late, isn't he? And, you know, grown-up discussion time. What's going on there?
I don't know. I think it's...
I have my own theory and I've had one for a little while, but I'll let Dave go first.
Yeah, just watching him. I mean, and sometimes I do deliberately just, you know, follow him when I'm watching the game and seeing what he's doing off the ball. And there's a few times when he's in his own half, he'll be ball watching. He gets drawn to the ball and he doesn't seem to be aware of what's happening off the ball. So you'll have the opposition midfield runners running behind him. And he's going towards the ball and leaving them free.
We saw this against Sheffield United particularly, didn't we?
Yeah, and so there's that problem. And then going forward, as I've just explained, there's that moment where he passes and then he stands stationary. I mean, sometimes, you know, players do that to give an out ball back just in case the player he's played it to is, you know, he's crowded out or whatever, he can obviously knock it back to him. But in many circumstances, he'd have been better served running on and overlapping or cutting inside to give that player a chance to either flick it on or, you know, thread him through. And then if he threads in Hourihan, you know, behind in between the midfield and the defence, then he's suddenly in that space where he can then feed through Abraham and, you know, slide rule pass or whatever. And he just seems a bit static. So for me, it's his off the ball game. Because when he's on the ball, I mean, after Abraham, he's responsible, you know, for the second amount of Villa goals, either from assists or, you know, from his own feet and, you know, set pieces. He's, you know, he's the odd worldy long shot, more so last season. But, you know, his corner deliveries are pretty poor this season as well. They're rarely beating the first man. So I don't know. What is it? Confidence? Actually not having that natural awareness and, you know, game, midfielder game off the ball?
I think it's a number of things with Hourihan, but I've been thinking this for a while in that when we bought him, he was one of those signings that you get the highlight reel and you go, oh, wow, you know, he scores great goals. But he was always going to stand out in a very, very average Barnsley team. And I just think maybe his ability has plateaued and the role that Smith wants him to play, it just doesn't necessarily work for him. You know, he's not physical enough to play in that role, I don't think. Teams just run through him. He's not nasty enough in the tackle. As you said, he's very tidy with the ball, but is he being asked to do something he's not necessarily that good at doing?
Grealish not being around, would you have played him in that role further up? Because he can shoot.
Yeah.
He can shoot. So as you said, I would pay him further forward, but Bruce also played him further back, deeper. And I just thought, well, he, defensively, his game's not up to scratch. He just doesn't read it that well. Surely his game is more further forward because we haven't got many impact players like him. I mean, he's no stranger to the assists. He's the fourth highest assist maker in the whole league.
Yeah, and I think when you put him in good positions, I think his delivery is generally good. And anyway, we know he can score goals. He's got a knack of getting on the end of things. I just think he's... with his skill set, I think he's kind of wasted where he is.
Yeah.
Would he benefit a game pushed further? I think he'll probably end up staying where he is for the time being, you know, for the next few games, obviously with McGinn being out, suspended, and Grealish sort of being eased back in off the bench, I would imagine. So, but I'd imagine if he was given the option, he'd like to play further forward where he would probably feel he can impact a game.
Yeah. Anything to add, Dan?
No, I don't want it to become the Horahan show. I just find it very interesting because...
Ladies and gentlemen, introducing the Conor Horahan show.
It would need a highlights reel, I think.
Problem is, he's suffering a lot from the crowd, and it can't help when you're in a stadium of, you know, 39,000 or however many... And people are calling you Paddy Bastard, an Irish this and Irish that.
I don't agree with any of that sort of stuff, and I would never condone, you know, singling out players. But I think one of the things with Horahan is, and it's always been the case with Villa in recent seasons, and it's been thrown at the team as well, is that the fans are almost waiting for the inevitable mistake, and the player probably thinks in his head, the crowd are waiting for me to make a mistake. So, of course, you play it safer and safer.
Do you think the club are in part responsible because... players like Horahan, and there have been others, are bought by the football club and paraded as being almost like the messiahs, if you like. That through him we will, you know, achieve salvation and get back to the Premier League. And the reality is that we're taking a big gamble, hoping that, as you said, that his quality doesn't plateau. And for me, it's very simple with Horahan. I think he's got some very, very good attributes. I think he's an impact player, possibly. And I also think that he would be in a midfield that perhaps has another runner and another physical player in or around him, because I won't go as far to say he's a luxury player.
He started the season off as a impact player off the bench. I mean, he was coming in off the bench, and just to defend him, in terms of Bruce's six permanents that he signed in January, his main window that was meant to build the foundations of his team, he is the only one who's actually stepped up in any shape or form. I mean, Lansbury's, Hogan, Bjarnason, Taylor. I mean, he's head and shoulders above them in terms of his contribution.
And for the money as well, the outlay for his investment.
Do you think he might be having a touch of the Petrovs about him? And I'm not making a comparison in terms of quality, but there was a period when Stylian Petrov, probably quite early in his Villa career, he couldn't make a pass. And there was a moment where he got hooked off. Maybe the Albion substitution could be Hurahan's equivalent, where, you know, you almost need to push the reset button on certain players. And as I think Smith perhaps needs to think about how he uses him. But Horahan maybe needs to think about what, you know, he's the focal point in that midfield for creativity, especially in the absence of Grealish, and how he feeds into that. Is quite important.
Yeah, I think he should be playing further forward, and I think this is something we always said back in the Bruce days as well. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, that is the end of the Conor Horahan show. Talking about toxicity, I mean, as well as racial slurs to players, you've got racial slurs to fans. I think I was speaking to a guy, although he's born in Birmingham, he's Indian by descent, and he said he walked out of, I think it was the Holt, when they were 3-0 down, and he got spat on for walking out. We had a letter from Adam. Sorry, Adam, I've only just mentioned this now, but Adam says he's 32 and mixed race. He said in that game against Cardiff last season, when we got dominated 3-0, Kenneth Zahor had a shot, keeper saved it, and the lad behind me decided that was reason enough to scream, "Fuck off, you black bastard," at him. I half lost my temper, pointed out that half of our team was black and he was a fucking idiot. I took all my willpower to not do something stupid, plus some support from my missus. I managed to calm down enough just to tell him and a mate to move away from me and go and stand elsewhere. On reflection, I really wish I'd gone to a steward / police, but, you know, hindsight is 20/20. He said he's 32 and grew up hearing Villa fans calling players black and then lots of asterisks. when they miscontrolled or messed up or scored, you know, or somebody scored against us. This was the 90s, so I know it's nothing like the preceding decades, and I'm not saying it was at every game, but it left enough of a mark on me. I'm a season ticket holder in the Upper Holt and generally still get anxious when a black player on either team does something shit or an opposition player scores, antagonizes the crowd. Without doubt, it's a small minority now, and I would agree with you that compared to other clubs, Villa is very multicultural, and it isn't as ingrained like somewhere else like Chelsea. But I just wanted to highlight, I've heard racism from Villa fans as recently as last season, and the prospect of it happening affects my matchday experience every time I take my seat on the Holt. So, I mean, I think we were talking, this letter came in, we were talking a few podcast episodes ago about how we thought that racism had, at least in terms of veneer, had left the stands. But you increasingly hear, I mean, I, you know, when you play Welsh teams or, well, sorry, Welsh players, you get the Welsh bastards, sheep shaggers and all that, you know, Swanseas, which people think's banter. And it-
I think what I've always noticed with the Villa fans is when things are going well, they're always going well. When things are going badly and the toxicity kicks in, some of the behaviour you see when the fans are getting the red mist is, and I'm sure this is the same with other clubs, it really brings out the worst. I've always thought
the veneer is stripped off.
The last few times we've been at Wembley, there's been so many incidents in the stand where you see Villa fans fighting Villa fans. And it was the same when the third goal went in against Sheffield United and the mass exodus started and there was all sorts going on up in the top of the whole end. And I just thought, this is embarrassing.
Yeah, and against West Brom, there was an incident in the Holt suite. I wasn't there, but apparently somebody threw a bottle of drink at somebody and the person who threw it, I think, left. And the person who the bottle hit or went in that direction of, he confronted somebody else thinking it was them and refused to believe it wasn't, even though they were saying the guy's gone outside. And I think it all kicked off from there. Punches were thrown. And I think there was another altercation. It's kind of spins off from just the... It's how the frustration of what's happening on the field manifests itself. And
I think we've discussed it before. It's almost this hangover from just 10 years of utter garbage that the Villa fans' patience is so thin, and the sort of resilience to bad news, if you want to call it that, a misplaced pass or whatever, the fans just blow up.
I mean, when people say, oh, Villa fans this, Villa fans that, it's every football club. The support is but a cross-section of society. Obviously, you've got all sorts. So you've got arseholes in there.
Especially online.
You've got good folk. You've got, you know, sound folk, some mentalists. There's a mixture. But when you get arseholes, I mean, I don't mind calling them out and shining a light. So like on this podcast, if we've called out Villa fans for something and somebody says on Twitter, oh, bagging out Villa fans, like I was, you know, for the Villa fans who were trying to get Tyrone Mings hung, drawn and quartered, accusing him of stamping on that player, he thinks that we're calling out Villa fans. We're not calling out Villa fans. We're calling out the particular people who were saying it, because everybody's different.
No, I mean, I agree with all of that. And I was just going to frame it in the context that there is something different in the modern game to what went before, you know, that they're, you know, I didn't go to football through the hooligan era, but I can think of games that we used to go, especially when I was very young with my dad, where we would go to places like St Andrews, and you know, those were genuinely toxic, borderline dangerous environments. I think the weird thing in the uber modern era with Villa is people's ability to not be able to hold a different opinion and not feel and not become irate about it. And I don't know, is that the social media thing? I mean, we both know from running big websites that, I mean, I'm not particularly careful in what I put out. I think about what I put out, but it always baffles me how people will draw some conclusion and become, I don't know, incredibly polarized by something that really doesn't require it. And you see that in the stands occasionally now, that people can't debate it.
There's one trend in, let's say, what's happened with the internet in terms of reporting, and it's not like it is a little bit the local newspapers, but mainly these football websites, which are essentially part of advertising networks, your snack media ones, which are like This Is Football, and I think Football League News and HITC, where they run these articles where they'll collect five or six tweets from fans slagging a player off, and they'll put the headline, Villa fans say it's time to bin Horahan, Villa fans hate Courtney House, Villa fans hate this. Villa fans get rid of this. Villa fans say he's the worst player ever to wear a claret and blue shirt. And the only justification for these articles is it's fucking just clickbait, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's all about the headline to create a scandal. Mm-hmm. All it is a few sentences and then just five or six tweets from some idiots. Just
it's fabrication,
to suit that clickbait agenda.
It's absolute fabrication, and that's very dangerous.
All these idiots are doing slagging off players. And, you know, constructive criticism is completely fine. But slagging off players, all they are, they're just like puppets to these ad agency stroke football sites just to make some ad revenue because they're just taking their tweets and putting them in these, I call them player hate articles. And then people read this and they go, oh, yeah, everybody hates Hourihan. And then that manifests itself onto the stands because people like to be sheep. And there's not many individuals out there. And they all like to chip in and feel like they're part of it, slagging somebody off because they've, you know, read these shitty articles.
And a good example of that at the moment, especially around the toxicity, and as we're just going into talking about Dean Smith or debating him, is that, and this is something we've spoken about since the inception of this podcast, is that suddenly conversations have become binary. With Dean Smith, you're with Dean Smith or you're with against him. No, Willem Fall in their right mind doesn't want him to come good, but it's okay to say, do you know what, things aren't going as they should be without someone carrying a knife into Villa Park, you know, and that's the world we live in.
And that happened against
Ipswich.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
But let's use this as a segue to get on to the Dean Smith debate. My stance on Dean Smith is this. As you said, there's this binary thing. Oh yeah, Dean Smith, oh, stick with him, we'll guarantee he'll get us that. There's no guarantee, and we'll explain why. But also, Dean Smith was selected to come to Villa. I think it was on the back of the broken Villa engine, where the club was desperately looking for they had no ethos in the field, they had no identity on or off the field, but they obviously wanted to, I mean, Buddy Moore Heath, what the hell's that all about? It's become a joke. So the Villa engine, which never, it just conked out before it was even plugged in or wound up or however it was being powered.
It was very nearly wound up.
So the Villa board, in their wisdom, thought, right, well, let's get a manager in to provide attacking football, entertain a brand of football that will obviously put bums on seats and could be the potential to kickstart this club into some direction, you know, casting an eye sideways to the likes of Swansea, you know, Southampton, Brentford, whatever. Dean Smith shining like a beacon because he's a Villa fan. So they go for Dean Smith.
After Henry turned us down.
When you elect politicians, it's normally on a manifesto, and Dean Smith's manifesto was attacking football, entertaining football, and hopefully winning football. We don't really hear that winning football mentioned much. So first half dozen games, we're getting exactly what it said on his manifesto, and you're thinking, this is good. Now, whether he gets promoted or not, I was kind of 50-50. It was like, well, I can kind of understand if he doesn't. Mm. But I mean, after we whooped Derby and Middlesbrough 3-0 away from home, you're thinking, hey, happy days. This guy's got us rocking and rolling from the off, and he's probably got the best players he's ever had to manage. So he's probably had, you know, he's excited in himself. And nobody was saying the players were shit then when they were kicking Derby's and Middlesbrough's asses. And that was completely unexpected. And the way they played had you believing. But what we've seen in 2019 is not what's in his manifesto. I don't know what's happening. People are making the comparison and saying, well, what's the difference between this and Bruce? And when you look at the last three games in particular, there isn't any difference. This is a team without any identity that you wouldn't even notice has the same actual, you know, players as the one in those first half dozen games. And this is the problem here, because when you look at Dean Smith, he is the least qualified manager to come to Aston Villa in my lifetime. And I've seen a few. He's got no pedigree. In terms of winning pedigree, as we pointed out at the start, I mean, I made the joke, good job he's a Villa fan, because he's only ever finished ninth with Warsaw or Brentford. And people go, well, he's got lack of resources. That's not an excuse. And we'll throw in some comparisons and comparisons that people have been making. And you ask me if those clubs had lots of resources. I think in the lower leagues, if you can manage, most teams in the lower leagues don't have resources. So if you're, it's all about, I think the lower leagues are a better judge of a manager's capability. Mm. And Warsaw fans will say, oh yeah, I play nice football, Brentford fans. But Brentford fans and Warsaw fans will also tell you about the defence and also going on long slumps of form. I mean, Brentford, some of them are chronic. I mean, this is not a binary debate. It's not going to be Dean Smith out or Dean Smith in. I think Dean Smith has to do something in the remainder of the games to get back to this manifesto. I mean, it's an interesting one, because obviously we're not going to have half the players, well, probably 75% of the players that he's got now. But he's got to start looking at next season, unless something's already happened behind the scenes. I mean, what's your take on it so far, before we kind of get into some of the lazy comparisons that people are offering up as placebos?
My observation is that it's...
Sorry to rant.
No, but they're all valid points. And I think if we're going to have the grown-up conversation, then it's important that all the cards are out on the table. And I'll caveat it by saying that I think Dean Smith needs time, as I advocated under Bruce, but there will come a time as well where the Walsall and Brentford comparisons will dissipate, because all football fans at this football club have an ambition to see Aston Villa as a minimum competing to get back into the Premier League. I think that's our baseline expectation, our minimum expectation.
Yeah.
The worry of what I've seen so far is he's had injuries, no doubt about it, and he's had key injuries. He lost Grealish to Anzebi and Chester. I think Chester was probably playing on one leg. The big concern for me is that we still have a good core of a team. I think we've still got a good squad, expensively assembled. The glaring issue for me, and it's come home particularly against how we came to be 3-0 down against Sheffield United, an abject 3-0 thumping away from home at Wigan, a comfortable victory for West Brom on our pitch, is our complete lack of a plan B, which is something Bruce came in for major criticism for. Well, our form's actually worse than it was under Bruce. And my worry is that we don't seem to change things in game. And what's the plan now to get us back into winning ways? Who are the players on the periphery? We talked at length about Hourihan. You know, isn't there another combination of midfield that we could be doing? Isn't there any support we could be providing from another striker or from look at El Ghazi. I think we've got an immensely talented player there who we've not managed to use in the entire time that Grealish has been off.
Well, I just interrupt you there. My friend was saying, Mr. Blick, who's probably will listen to this show, he said he was sitting at Villa, I forgot which game it was, he was sitting next to two Ajax fans who just happened to be at Villa Park, and they were laughing at El Ghazi. Every time he touched the ball, they were laughing and basically ridiculing him from what they had seen back in the day at Ajax. But, I mean, that's one example, but another example is, you know, a friend of mine said he had potential and he was kind of good on the ball, he held the ball really well. Going back to what you're saying, we've seen enough from him to suggest he can be very useful and a potent force. It's just we have pieces to play, but I don't think we're playing them, are we?
No, and that's I can see and I understand what Dean Smith's trying to do, but you can't. The way I framed it was that how long do you persevere with a philosophy whilst it's faltering? And that's not to say you can't return to that philosophy. My view when he came to the club was that at Brentford or at Walsall, that you can play to a style, but you are ultimately going to be limited in, I don't know, raising it to becoming a very competitive or a league winning team, possibly on, not necessarily on resource, but on attracting players that lift you above other teams in that division. And that's something that even this season with the squad we've got and the trouble we've been through, I still think we've got them a squad that's assembled that can compete. I do believe that. I don't think it's necessarily the best team in the league, but I think we can compete.
Chris has said several times on the podcast that Dean Smith's way, and I'm going to read you some of the runs he's had at Brentford. Dean Smith's philosophy works if the team is playing that ethos spot on.
Yeah.
If it's not tight on its high press, then it's really open to the counter attack. And this is why, and this is from a Brentford fan who wrote about Dean Smith after he left. Dean Smith was well known for his patchy runs at Brentford. In his first season, he had a run where Brentford lost 10 out of 13 games, winning 2 and drawing 1, before then winning 7 out of 9. I mean, losing 10 out of 13 games, you're sacked from most clubs. Mm. This is his first season. Obviously, Brentford finished 5th in the first season in the Championship, and then Smith took over. I think they finished 10th in this season. Following season, I think they finished 9th. We went on a run which saw us win 5 out of 21 games, including the 3-0 win against Villa, and they lost 11 of those. Last season, we won only one match in our first 11. This season, when Dean Smith left us, we hadn't won for 6 matches, and they hadn't actually won an away game this season either. So these are some horrific runs of form, which pretty much rubber stamp you as a mid-table team, and that explains why he's never finished higher than 9th ever. And this is what we're in the middle of now. So there's something... This is not the first time this has happened to a Dean Smith team. This repeatedly happens. On due diligence, you wouldn't have got him in based on this.
It's a certain amount of, I'll call it, footballing naivety. I've spoken about this before, that so many fans, so many teams, managers, they have this, I call it, Guardiola envy. Everybody wants to play this stunning ball retention, continental style of football. That's brilliant. If you're Manchester City and you've got £50 million players in every position who are more than technically capable of doing that, on the other side of that, when they don't have the ball, they work harder than any team in this country, Man City.
Yeah.
Isn't it like a 3-second rule or whatever to get the ball back?
Yeah.
You're talking about exceptional individuals. These are a cut above pretty much any team we've seen play in the Premier Division era, I would argue, in terms of philosophy and style. The unbeatable Arsenal teams are close. But you know, a lot of the Fergie teams were a lot more functional.
Yeah.
With Villa, I just throw at him that he hasn't got that ability, as I said in previous podcasts, when it's not bang on the money, like at Derby, where we were utterly dominant and completely monopolised the ball and just played him off the park in every way. Middlesbrough was the same.
Yeah.
And we got chances, we took them. If anything goes slightly off kilter, or you come up against a team who has a plan to negate you, like the Baggies did, and I thought Sheffield United were the same, you know, both teams without massively standout individuals, but just really well-oiled units. Brentford were a well-oiled unit, and they got the job done. And I think what he'll have to learn at Villa, and he's maybe going to have to learn in his career, is that he's going to have to be a bit pragmatic every now
That's
and then.
That's a good point.
And say, as we've said with a plan B, and saying, do you know what? I want to play open, attractive football. But like with, I would say, like a Ferguson team, you know, on their day, they could batter anyone by playing expansive, amazing football.
Yeah.
But when it came down to the nitty gritty, if they had to go away from home and play rough and fight and grab one off someone's backside in the 93rd minute of Fergie time, they could do that as well. And I don't see Dean Smith as a pragmatic manager who can, as you said, like a plan B or a plan C. His teams don't play badly and win.
The biggest cliche in football is to be a successful team, you have to be able to play badly and win. And if, for example, we're not pressing tight enough in the Dean Smith way, and Brentford fans have said this, they were so susceptible to the counter. And the amount of times that diagonal ball, because we haven't closed down somebody and he's had a couple of seconds to look up, and they've delivered that ball, diagonal ball to the wings, and suddenly Hudson or Taylor's suddenly got two men running at him, breathing down his neck. He's outnumbered straight away. And that's how we've been cut open numerous times against Hull, against QPR, against Forest, against Sheffield United.
You need legs, and you need, you know, a real high levels of fitness to play the way Smith wants them to play, because you're going to do a lot of running.
I think that the issues that are really hurting us aren't as complicated as you rightly say, this Guardiola style that you know you can't run before you walk, can you? And for me,
no.
I think Smith would have had so much more, I say the phrase, easy wins, but it's a truism in football, I guess, in this case, if he'd have focused solely upon shoring up the defence, because it's months now where we start football games where you think we're going to need to score two or three goals
really
to win this game.
We started, aren't we?
And that you can't go into games knowing that.
I haven't checked in the last couple of weeks, but his average under Smith, we were conceding two goals a game at Villa Park. And considering we just conceded another two, I'm pretty sure it's around that figure at the moment. Since we conceded three against Sheffield United, so we are needing three goals minimum.
You know, and that, against a backdrop of last season, you know, we were virtually unbeaten at Villa Park. It's gone on its head, really.
Yeah. I mean, I remember using the stat that we laughed at before the Blues game, but it was true last season and in previous seasons. Really, if Villa took the lead at Villa Park, we weren't losing. Yeah. We scored first. It was like, well, you the maximum you're getting out of this is a point. Whereas with Villa, you know, like you look at the Leeds game, you think, you know, 2-0 up against most teams.
No one was confident. Thinking, yeah.
No. I mean, as I said on the podcast after the Leeds game, I turned to the person sitting next to me at Villa Park and said, "We're going to need three." At half time, I said, "We're going to need three."
Sheffield United, we're going to need four. Nottingham Forest, we're going to need six.
It's like the Jaws film. It's like we're going to need a bigger boat.
We're going to need a smaller goal. We're going to need a bigger keeper.
Well, we've got a big keeper now, 6'7", and he's still getting lobbed by looping headers. When he was lying on the ground looking at the sky he got injured just before halftime, I was just saying to the person next to me, he's just looking at the sky and saying, "Get me out of here." And I said, he's told that physio to get me an Uber at halftime, get me out of here. And then he didn't turn up for the second half. I thought, bloody hell, I was only joking, but it seems to have come to pass.
We mentioned Leeds, and the thing I'll throw to Leeds and Norwich this season is the amount of times I've walked out the Villa and seen that our Leeds are still playing and they've nicked a last minute win or a draw.
Yeah, that's another good sign.
These teams are just, you know, when someone goes and gets the result at Villa Park that Leeds did, you think this is a team that's going up. Yeah. And the same with Norwich. They've had multiple games where they've won it late. And
we're saying, you know, you can't say Dean Smith out now because managers need time. And when you look back at the summer, what happened at Villa, I mean, we didn't even know we would have a club at one stage. I mean, that may be an over-exaggeration, but it was pretty pathetic. And so you thought, well, I wouldn't put any money on us getting promoted this forthcoming season. So there's that in the back of your mind. You know there's a big overhaul. New owners have come in, new board. Obviously, we've flipped a manager and we're battling financial fair play. But I thought the squad they actually put together was good enough to get in the playoffs. I mean, I expect Villa to get challenged for automatic, but I thought, okay, I'm happy to scrape into the playoffs. And that team, the way we looked suddenly when Smith came along, you thought, ooh, the way we dealt with Derby, Middlesbrough, who will be in and around those playoffs, I fancy us against anybody in the playoffs, to be honest. More so this time round than last season. So he needs time. The question is, though, and that's the big question. I mean, as I said, for us to be all comfortable and to give him that time, he needs to deliver that manifesto of what I was talking about at the top, this attacking football. And we haven't seen that in pretty much the whole of 2019. So you look around social media and, you know, certain people who try to push themselves out as the voice of Aston Villa fans, and they want to comment every time, even though if they're not at games or whatever. And they start to come out with these very lazy comparisons. And the bottom line is, this manager needs time. And of course, other managers have had time and they've been successful. But the Smith thing, he hasn't got any pedigree, so you cannot guarantee that he will be a success. The bottom line is he has to deliver the reason why we got him in the first place, and that's how we judge him. He's not doing it at the moment. He needs to do something before the end of the season, I feel. But people look at Daniel Farke and say at Norwich and say, well, he was doing bugger all last season. Look at Norwich, they were shedding their best players, but look at them now. And Dean Smith will do exactly that. Well, you know, Farke does have pedigree because in the lower leagues of Germany, you know, he took SV Lippstadt 08 to double promotion, a couple of promotions in the lower league. I think they went from like the sixth German league to the fourth before he came over. And it's what I was talking about, this lower league pedigree, like Chris Wilder, Sheffield United, won the conference with Oxford United, went to Northampton, won the League Two with Northampton, then went to the Blades, won Division One. So he knows how to get his team over the line, which suggests they know how to defend, they know how to organise teams to be a winning unit, to win ugly as well as, you know, win on the front foot. Somebody said, oh, this just reminds me exactly of when Brian Little took over to try to put this kind of romanticism that Dean Smith is the man, because people have been saying Dean Smith 100% guaranteed he will turn it around, and you can't do that. I'm not saying you won't, but I'm not saying there's no guarantees, because he has shown no pedigree. Brian Little, he's got nothing to do with Dean Smith. It's not an equivalent at all. When Little took over from Ron Atkinson, in the Little's best season, when he won the League Cup, got in the semi-final of the FA Cup and finished fourth, Mark Bosnick, Paul McGrath, Hugo Ekiog, Dwight York were all in the team, and Andy Townsend was the captain, and Steve Staunton was an integral part, and these were all Ron Atkinson players, obviously. Obviously, Paul McGrath was brought in by Graham Taylor, but these were players that were already there. The spine of that team, of a very good team that he took over, that obviously just lost its way a little under Big Run, was already there. But more importantly, Brian Little had pedigree, winning pedigree as a manager. Consecutively had won the conference title with Darlington, had won the fourth division, League Two now, in consecutive seasons. Then when he went to Leicester, he got into the what is now the Championship, the playoffs, 3 years on the trot, and eventually won the last one to get Leicester promoted to the Premier League.
For that team, Martin O'Neill took a lot of the credit, but it was actually Little's team.
Exactly, and obviously O'Neill went on to win a couple of League Cups with them. And Little came to Villa as a young manager who's, I think, around 6 years younger than Smith was when he took over. So there's no comparison between Little and Smith.
I think with Little compared to Smith, what you saw when Little arrived was, you know, he had that similar sort of wobble. I think it took him six games to get the first win, but then through December to March, they lost 1-11. And he'd, unlike Smith, where a lot of this the dealings he's done are loan players, you know, he had a core, but you had players like Barrett.
It was a very good core.
Yeah, very good core. But you had players like, you know, Earl Barrett, Whittingham, your captain in Kevin Richardson, Parker, Houghton. People like that all got jettisoned very quickly. And he knew that, okay, I want to bring my guys in. And he went out and bought Johnson and Charles and Wright, who over the coming two or three seasons became integral players. Obviously, he brought in Ian Taylor. You know, he did the heavy lifting, if you want to call it that, quite quickly, and realised that, okay, these guys aren't going to be
here. He was also
here.
Quite radical as well. That, you know, he adopted a wing-back system that was quite revolutionary in England at the time.
Yeah. He built it very early so that the next season, I think he only brought in three players, didn't he? It was obviously Southgate, Draper and Milosevic. And he even had the courage to say, do you know what? Saunders and Atkinson have been your main guys that, you know, shot you to second in the Premier League and won you a cup, and they're gone.
Yeah, but the bottom line was, we got him because he had winning pedigree. He had achievements, and it wasn't just because he used to play for Aston Villa or was a Villa fan. And I'm sorry, but you look at Graham Turner, who had a hand in dismantling us as European champions. But Turner, like Smith, spent his playing days as a central defender in the lower leagues. Turner actually won League One with Shrewsbury. And then in five seasons in the what would be now the Championship, his highest finish was eighth, which obviously is very similar to Smith's ninth. And that was his crowning achievement, that Doug Ellis brought him in because he just thought this was one of the brightest young English managers. Nobody had heard of him at the time. Doug Ellis had to do a bit of a second-hand car salesman job on us all just to convince him that this was the future. And, you know, within two seasons, he was out of there and we were on our way to get relegated.
The same applies with some of the, you know, there's been comparisons to like the first season of O'Neill, but I'd apply the same with Little in that O'Neill...
Shitloads of money.
Yeah, and he knew that he wanted to get rid of players, but he brought in, you know, the likes of Young and Carew, Petrov, these kind of guys. He really did that heavy lifting of, right, I'm going to use this season, I will develop it for next season. I don't see at the moment the plan where you think, okay, do you know what, that's the spine next season.
O'Neill had winning pedigree as a manager, obviously, in Celtic and Leicester. He'd won things. Yeah. So nobody can guarantee, I've seen, you know, people who run websites, whatever, 100% guarantee Smith will be, and it's this romanticism because he's a Villa fan, you can't guarantee other fans anything about Smith because he's never proved it. This was hopefully, as we used to say early doors, hopefully he has this philosophy and this bigger canvas that Villa will give him hopefully helps him fulfill that ideology in the best, you know, best possible way that he's never been able to in the past, because he's been essentially, no disrespect to them, but managing tin pot teams, pub teams. To give them their proper name.
The depressing reality is our season is all but over in mid-February. So now you want to see the signs and, you know, the seeds being sown of next season, them getting their shit together
and
as early as possible.
This is where I stick my nose in, because this is the, if the season is over in February, ordinarily I wouldn't say I'd shrug my shoulders, but you could say, well, you've got 3 months now as your sandbox to find who in the squad you want to keep, et cetera, et cetera. Completely. The trouble is we've got so many loans, so many players who we probably know we don't want to keep, or here's the uncomfortable truth, can't afford to keep, that, you know, if, assuming we're still down here, that you're going to see wholesale change anyway. And it does make me intrigued to see what will happen over the next 3 months in what could possibly be quite a disappointing run of fixtures, not only for all the reasons that we've said, but actually how's Smith going to plan for the future? And are we going to see more Ramseys appearing? Are we going to see different formations, or are we going to try and play to this philosophy using what we've got? It's a bit clunky for me, and I think it could polarise people.
You've got a problem, Dan. If, let's say, I don't know, we get a draw against Stoke. Derby, it's not a walk in the park. And then we play the Blues without having won in the, well, what will it be? It'll be like two wins in 15 games going into that game. And if the Blues beat us, we haven't beaten the Blues at St Andrews since we've been down it. If they beat us, how is life going to be for Smith?
Well, I dropped my phone the other day and someone who shall remain nameless sent me a WhatsApp, and within the message it said, once we're mathematically safe.
Ah, yes.
And it suddenly dawned upon me that it's awfully tight, isn't it? The middle bottom third of the championship all of a sudden.
You know, we could go down as far as 16th or 17th position in the next 2 weeks.
Is that right?
I think...
well, you're relying on other teams to do the work.
One below us has got a game on us. So actually, we could plummet.
So the reason we're saying this is, if Smith is to be afforded time, he has to show evidence of he is playing attacking football. But we don't have the easiest of fixture lists. And we have pivotal games, like if you're losing against the Blues away, which will make the toxic Avengers of the crowd kind of boil up. And they'll start calling for him. And it's going to be uncomfortable.
I mean, Blues away is one of those games where actually he's got an opportunity to salvage a bit of pride.
Yeah, he can shut them up. He wins that, and he's bought himself to the end of the season without any real issues, I would say. So there is a potential get out of jail card there. If he wins that, if he loses that, it doesn't really alter the bigger picture for me. He has to show evidence that, because he hasn't got the pedigree. It's like getting a loan from the bank. He's got no security because he's got no pedigree of winning things. He's never shown that he can do something before.
And in terms of the derby game, you know, win, lose or draw, the fact that we currently sit beneath a team that's had a transfer embargo and hasn't bought any players says a hell of a lot about the club as an overall entity, you know, on and off the
field.
That's
like another podcast in its entirety. I mean, the only, the main reason why I'm saying, well, you know, obviously Smith, while no pedigree, you should have thought that at the time of, you know, employing him, but why you hang on to the hope that potentially he could be the way forward is they were so devastatingly good against Borough, against Derby, that you thought, hang on a minute, there's potential there. And it's just seeing that, it's just like a little insight, even though it wasn't a lot in the context of what we've had to put up with over the last few months, it was enough to keep the candle of hope burning in terms of Dean Smith.
Completely.
And so that's why you're giving him the benefit of the doubt. But I'm expecting more in these. I mean, if the Baggies beat us at Villa Park, no problem if we've given them a game. Mm-hmm. But we gave them a game at their patch, but this seems to be, it's not even the same team. Okay, Grealish is gone, but I'm sorry, but Grealish played and Tuanzebe played in that game where we drew 5-5 against Forest, where you saw the good, bad and the ugly of Dean Smith team in that game. And there's no excuse, Grealish out. You should have a unit that's organised, that can defend, that can grind out draws, but also stay solid and then nick a goal. Because, hey-ho, you know, we've got Tammy Abraham up front, and we did have some exciting wingers, and we could create chances. So we'd always get a chance or two. And by the way, I think we're the third highest, we've had the third highest shots on goal in the league. I think it's 14.1 per game. So we've created chances. We just needed to tighten up at the back. And if we just turn three or four of these draws into wins, which we're more than capable of, then we'll be still talking about the playoffs.
I mean, we've said it numerous times, haven't we, how we could have been pretty bloody average this season and still been challenging.
Yeah, when Grealish went out, you just thought, well, we just got to keep it together. grind out a few wins here and there.
And stay in touch.
Stay in touch. He comes back. We'll finish off the job, get in the playoffs. He was probably the potential difference if we were firing on all cylinders for actually automatic. But he still hasn't proved himself.
Yeah.
You know, Grealish started 21 games this season. And this is meant to be the best player in the championship, according to Dean Smith. Never proven that. Never finished a whole season. 21 games, 2 goals, 4 assists. Yannick Bolasie, everybody slagged him off. Villa fans slagged him off, as they do. Started 9 games, scored 2 goals, 4 assists, exactly the same as Jack Grealish. Came on as a sub, I think, 12 times. So 21 appearances each, but Grealish obviously played many, many more minutes and started 21 games to his 9. Grealish is playing in that number 10 role most of the time. He's the furthest forward behind Abraham. He's the best player in the championship, allegedly. He's meant to be changing games. He scored 2 goals, 4 assists. That is not that impactful. Okay, when he's got the ball, he's drawing free kicks, he's drawing fouls, he's creating space for other people because he's drawing in 2 or 3 players. But is he making that much of an impact? I'd argue not. He's not winning matches with key stats.
Well, it's end product, isn't it? It's that old sort of chestnut.
So he's not an excuse for Villa's, for one man going out of the team that changes the whole dynamic of the team. And this team is listless, because if Villa were playing entertaining football as they were in the first half dozen games, and we were still getting the same results, I don't think there would be that lashing out from fans and that kind of toxicness, because they've been sold down the river, because this man's suddenly changed the whole way that he plays. It's kind of strange. So what do you think he needs to do with the remaining fixtures, apart from beat the Blues, obviously, which would obviously buy him some time, just to wrap up here?
I mean, it's using his time wisely, isn't it? It's working out who of the guys who are currently on loan with options to buy are likely to stay. It's the behind the scenes stuff will be, well, do you think, you know, to players, are you going to be here next season realistically? Because if you don't think you are, I'm going to have to make a decision on whether I choose to play you, put you in a shop window.
Yeah, but never mind about this. This is what he's doing already. I'm talking about fans putting up with him, thinking, like, if we drop and we finish lower mid-table, just above the relegation zone, and we've hardly won a game, people are going to be saying, what chance have we got? And this, I mean, of all the seasons, this season has given me a direct insight into how the likes of Forest have stayed in this league for 20 seasons. Mm. Sheffield Wednesday have stayed 19, Leeds, how many? You know, the last 3 seasons has whizzed by.
Yeah, I'm similar, I guess. I've got complete clarity on that too, because it's deja vu, isn't it, that we've had in the 3 years we've been down here. It's just been cycles of the same, just with, you know, different peaks and troughs, really. For Smith, and given where we are and all that's gone before, what we know, how good the team can possibly be on its day, right down to how bad it can be, even with the confines of his small era, is I think he would do well to get Villa competitive again. I think that you could be... you could be 18th in this division, scrapping around. But if the team's fighting, showing fight, showing an intention to improve, I think fans will buy into that. I'm not saying it's what people will be happy with, because obviously we wouldn't be. But I think the difference between being almost, it's the comfortable nature of victories that really, really bothers me. And the Albion game sort of, I guess it bottles it, doesn't it, that a team comes to Villa Park under no great pressure for long periods of the game, and they get a comfortable victory after a double hit on us. And that's that.
Yeah.
It's kind of showing willing, isn't it? It's that word we've used loads of times, is being proactive.
Well, it's a pragmatism. It's a word that you used. It's a word that I used in my piece. I think that the vast majority of fans are realistic and reasonable. They'll think about the Villa in terms of where we're at, all that's gone before, the dreadful summer that we had, the fact that we were almost out of business, the disaster that was unfolding with Bruce, who realistically would probably have been sacked after his playoff final defeat last summer. You get Dean Smith, who wasn't your first choice. Uncomfortable truth. Another awkward transfer window. You've got dreadful defence with no cover. You've got a very unbalanced midfield. You know, who would have envisaged, you know, another long-term injury to Grealish, the unbalance there. And yet at the same time, it's juxtaposed against great players like McGinn coming through. You've got a great goal scorer in Abraham. That's where I'm at.
I mean, it's sod's law where we finally get a... it's a bit like when we got Darren Bent, it was too late.
Yeah.
We get Abraham and it's a complete waste of time. And we get Benteke, a complete waste of time. He kept us in the league, but if you had Benteke when Martin O'Neill was in town, we would have torn it up. We would have been in Europe without a fucking doubt.
I mean, look at what makes us happy as fans. That who would have thought that Hutton steamrolling the Blues midfield and defence and scoring that goal as he did would become probably run on the highlights reel forever. But what it shows is that Hutton isn't the most talented player in the world, but he's got endeavour and he's got commitment, etc., etc.
On Hutton, I have to admit, I've watched the last few games and it only dawned on me halfway in that Brentford game when I saw the captain's armband on Hutton's arm. That was the first time it dawned on me that Alan Hutton was the Aston Villa captain.
Mm. Quite staggering, isn't it, really?
So back in the day when we got him, he was like third choice right back at Spurs. And then bomb squad, and you admire his effort, and you know it's almost a cult hero for sure, and it's been a journey. The Alan Hutton story is quite a fun footballing story in terms of being a cult player, and his effort is undeniable. And on a personal level, to go from the bomb squad and out of the door to winning a couple of new contracts and getting the captain's armband is astonishing in the context of things. But it's almost like while the war has been going on and we're getting bombarded, he's managed to live in a little hut somewhere unnoticed and survived.
Yes.
He's not going to get in any of the Premier League teams anymore. And yet he's our captain. And we're meant to have Dean Smith, who is the super Villa supporting version of Pep Guardiola, and yet Alan Hutton is his captain. It doesn't really correlate.
Certainly till May. I just want to see us doing simple things well, passing, moving, first ball, second ball, you know.
Yeah, there's none of that. There isn't that. And that's been the worrying thing. It's all disappeared.
It was like club team, wasn't it? It was embarrassing, some of the first touches Villa players had and the shape, lack thereof, and real, you know, fundamental things that professional footballers do in training every day.
And, you know, people are talking, you know, people watch Brentford, you know, they've schooled us three times on their patch and they're making it, oh, Dean Smith was behind this, you know, hang on, it's taken him 3 years to do this. And then...
been hanging my whole lifetime.
And then, you know, they play Swansea in the cup, and Swansea catch them exactly how they used to, you know, catch Dean Smith when he was manager of Brentford on the counter-attack. I think it was for the second goal I saw, it was like woeful. And, you know, they lost a man, so they went from 2-1 to 4-1. So you could probably make allowances for that. But other teams don't struggle beating Brentford.
Could you even make the little argument at the moment, Smith just can't buy a break? You know, he can't get his players he wants fit playing, can't even get them on the field.
But how many times have we played teams who have had chronic injury crisis? You know, we played Preston once and they couldn't even field.
They had 10 players.
Yeah, couldn't even field first choice defender. And, you know, I don't think we won, did we? I think we drew.
Oh, yeah, we drew away.
And so we're missing a couple of guys and we're crying and blaming the whole season on that, where other teams just soldier on, get on with it and do the job.
United rested the league's top goal scorer on the weekend in favour of Scott Hogan.
Exactly.
On that note,
that's all you need to know. So the good news is Scott Hogan's touch meter is up and running again. The bad news is Villa are very much standing still and we are looking just for a sign that the Dean Smith project does actually have legs. Because, forget any comparisons, there's no pedigree there, so we can't rely on something that's already happened as collateral or a precedent or evidence. We have to, for now, give him time. But I think the rest of the season's a trial, really. He's been given 2.5-year contract, so they know he's not the done deal because you'd give a manager 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. So they'll give him next season, obviously, because they've invested time in the infrastructure. So this kind of Smith out toxicity isn't really, I think, at the moment viable. I think it will step up another level if he hasn't won until they play the Blues and then the Blues beat us. But as we said, win it. And he's got himself out of jail, and I think he exists to the end of the season. We'll talk, I think, about the rebuilding job in another podcast, because it's hard to ascertain what resources we'll actually have to undertake that, and what kind of commodity are Villa now to attract players? Because, as we've said before, the whole, join Villa, we'll get promoted this season, and you'll be playing for a big team in the Premier League. Yeah, that doesn't really wash anymore, that little gambit.
See you in August.
What's our motivation to keep going? That's the bigger question. Never mind keeping Smith.
Me and Dan have paid for our season tickets, so we want to get our money's worth.
We want to be part of the park. Right.
Oh, it's so bad.
So, listeners, for those of you who are already part of the Pride and are considering whether to degrade to being part of the park, we'll leave you with that thought while we head off into the ether. In the meantime, please do subscribe to us on, or follow us on Spotify, subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever other app. Also, please do, if you're enjoying the show, please do spread it on Twitter and Facebook. If you get the chance, get it out there to hopefully you will have friends who are also like-minded, who want a bit of entertainment and some serious independent discourse rather than just people saying things to try to attract likes and popularity. And also, please do become a patron. That is the best thing you can do at this moment in time to keep us going. Every patron lights up my day when I'm feeling depressed.
Sunshine into our lives.
Well, it is. I mean, sometimes I feel depressed as fuck, thinking, I think it's time to call it a day. But then just knowing that people are willing to back you in that way does stiffen the resolve to carry on. Anyway, until next time, it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from them.
Goodbye.
Hurrah.
My old man said.
Welcome to the end of season party. Party, party, party.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.